And so when I say, like, why do you not feel like garbage when if she was to buy a yacht, the answer is like, well, they're in a she's in a completely different financial sphere than me. Like, we're not even comparable. She's completely different. And so my answer to that is, well, pretty much so is everyone in your entire life, unless you know the ins and outs of their entire financial situation.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As an anthropologist and naturopathic doctor, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass, these are the themes that we're exploring. Before we jump into the interview, I want to invite you to join our free Facebook community, Legacy. If you want to be something amazing, you need to surround yourself with amazing people. The Legacy community is made up of badass women living, not leaving, but living our legacy every single day. We are leaders, parents, entrepreneurs, and innovators collectively committed to leaving the world better than we found it. My mission is to support the health and optimization of these badass superheroes, literally to places we never thought imaginable. If you are on a mission and get it that your health is the key to your unlimited potential, then join us. We are super awesome. You can find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/groups/BE Legacy. See you there. Today was a super fun interview. It was all about money. Well, not exactly money per se, but our attitudes towards money, our core beliefs with respect to money. And we segued into this concept of how do you actually spend money guilt-free? I bet you actually didn't think I was going to go there. My guest today was Shannon Simmons. Shannon is the author of Worry-Free Money, which is released today. She owns the New School of Finance, and she runs a series of programs online to teach the notion of financial acumen. She is a new mom. She gets the pressures of the millennial and emerging entrepreneurial lifestyle and the shift that we're seeing in our society away from the idea that everything is secure and easy to the fact that we need to have a new idea and a new paradigm as we approach money. When people come in for their intakes with me, there are a few areas that I see as being consistent sources of stress. And it doesn't matter how much money someone makes or appears to have, finances are nearly always a source of consistent high stress in someone's life. I can't have a podcast or a business that focuses on producing healthy outcomes for people if we don't talk about money. And that's exactly what we did today. That is exactly why I'm so excited to share this interview with you between myself and Shannon Simmons. Shannon Simmons, welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
I'm so excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk about a topic that is really of interest to me. And I've gotten into this with the Entrepology Podcast audience before, and that is the concept of money. And this is a part of my personal journey, but it's also something that when I have intake forms for new patients who come into my office and I look at the areas of stress in their life, the thing that always comes up is they're there because of their health, but finances are always that second feature. And it's something that we just don't talk about. Well, I should say we don't, but you do. And I'm really excited to get into that topic with you today. Can you share with us how you got to this place? How is it that you are not just an expert on finances, but you've really positioned that knowledge in a totally unique way? You are all about empowerment. And we're going to get into this a little bit more throughout the course of the interview, but now we're going to look at guilt-free spending, our relationships with money. How did you get here?
So I run a business called New School of Finance. And so because of that business, we provide affordable fee-only planning. And the reason I say that is because we can deal with clients from all walks of life. So we have some clients who are sinking in debt, and we also have clients who have over $1 million and everyone in between there. And one of the things that I've noticed, and I've been running New School. So I used to work on like Fancy Bay Street. I quit in 2010, and I've been doing New School or some iteration of it ever since. And so after, 10 years in the industry, working with all kinds of people, families, single people, there are very similar themes between all of us. And a lot of times what happened was I started putting together like, wow, it doesn't really matter if you make $30,000 a year or $130,000 a year. Everyone's kind of doing the same thing and feeling the same way about their money, and they're stressed out about it. And so I started to notice that trend over time. And then after you see that those trends over time, it's like you can't not say something, because part of the solution became almost repetitive, what I would say to all my different clients. And that's why I got the idea to take everything I've learned from my New School in Finance practice and actually put it into a book.
Yeah, and I'm really excited to actually get into the book. But let's just do that. Let's start really, really high level. And I know one of the key features about this book is this notion of like guilt-free spending. Like, how do we actually do what we want to do with money without it getting us into trouble? Are there some simple things that we need to look at?
Yeah, well, I think that identifying the problem is the first part, so that people are aware of why they feel guilty when they spend money. And I think that there's two things. So money is so emotional, right? Like, it absolutely is a wellness thing. It has everything to do with how we feel about ourselves, our self-worth, everything. It's so inextricably linked to that. And that's why it's so important to even fundamentally feel good about your financial life. And so when we feel guilty about money, it's usually because we feel like there isn't enough. And that's kind of like what makes us feel broke. So we feel guilty about spending, we feel like we don't have enough money, then we feel broke, and then we give up because we're like, what's the point of trying? I don't have enough money to ever do anything that I want. And what's it like? What's the point? And then we feel unmotivated. So we really kind of honed in on the fact that if we can find a way to be guilt-free about spending money and give ourselves permission to do that and to enjoy the same money that we have, then we can probably have a happier financial life and an overall better wellness. So identifying the problem. The problem is that there is so much noise on the internet, in the media, from parents at the holidays, like whatever it is, there's a lot of noise coming at people to save, right? Save your money. Don't let money sit in your checking account. You got to make it work for you. And a lot of people feel like, oh my gosh, there's this intense pressure to save money. And we hear all these doom and gloom every day with like, you know, housing prices are rising, debt is rising, jobs are going down. Like, it's scary. I often say that we're living in the financial upside down. Like, it's scary out there. And so we want to save money because we don't want to be like the grasshopper who sang all summer, right? And then on the other side of the coin, we have an intense pressure to spend money, which is coming at us from our, again, friends, family, and media, with messages from social media. We compare ourselves to people without even trying to, you know, I'll use the holidays again as an example. The holidays are like spend, buy a house, don't miss out on housing. Housing's only going up. And so you have your friend's bachelorette party, and then you have this wedding too, and then there's another destination coming down the wire, and then you need a new pair of pants. So there are worrying things with your money. One side of you is terrified and you feel like you need to save every damn dollar or else you're financially stupid. And the other side is this intense pressure to spend, which they're conflicting. So if you give in to one, you're hurting the other side of you. So if you save, then you don't have enough money to go to your friend's birthday party and you feel like a bad friend. You feel guilty about that. And if you spend the money and you spend the $100 and you go to the birthday party, well, then you feel guilty to yourself at 3 a.m. because you didn't put money into your RSP. So this is the conundrum that we're in. And so I feel like it's like reached a fever pitch. I think it's always been this, but I think that given the media and the access to information and the overdrive of resources out there, just like nonstop noise, it gets confusing and it can feel like, what's the point? I can't win. I'm screwed either way. And so yes, there is a possible, that's how everyone feels. I can tell you, I've looked in the finances of so many people and I can tell you that everyone feels like this, like that's the conundrum. And so what do you do? Okay. So first things first is we need to save something, right? I mean, like the whole idea behind saving to appease that fear-based scarcity mindset that we all have as human beings, which is what keeps us alive. We need to save something because at some point, if you've got debt, you've got to pay it down. Or if you are precariously employed or self-employed, you need a little bit of an emergency savings account. So we need to do something. So some action is necessary. So the first thing that I would do is kind of like lay out what are some of those realistic goals that you want to achieve. And I say realistic because too often you hear like, you know, you need $1 million. Well, you know, the average person might not be able to get there. So like, screw that. Why don't we just look at what this person needs within their realistic time horizons for their income and how that works for them. So figuring out like what you need to do to pay your bills, keep a roof over your head, you know, pay for your car insurance, and then also put a little bit of money aside to move yourself forward is the first step, and being realistic about that. And then the other side is actually the most important side. So in the book, I basically say something that's like kind of controversial. We'll see what Twitter has to say about it. But like, I basically think that budgets are broken. I think that no one should budget their money ever again. I think that it's making things worse.
Ooh, I like this.
Yeah. So the reason is that typically when you want to appease that scarcity mindset and you want to save your money, you turn to budgeting as like the answer to financial responsibility. Like if you follow this plan, you're guaranteed to win, right? And so traditional budgets force you to like, you categorize your spending and they call it disposable income, which I think is disgusting because I don't think that any part of my income is disposable. So like the money that makes up my life is not disposable. Why would we call it that? But anyways, you typically take all of your spending money, categorize it into these micro cousins, like we have our pants and then we have, you know, LCBO and wine store. Okay. Then we have takeout and then we have dining out and then we have coffee shops and all these small little categories. And then you're supposed to forecast what you think you're going to spend for the next month or year. And then do your damnedest to live within those confines of this restrictive budget. And it's like the worst diet in the world, right? It's like counting calories and macronutrients and trying to like live your life within the confines of something that is so ridiculously unrealistic. Life is so unpredictable. One grocery shop, you might need to like you might be on quote on budget. And then the next one, you might need to buy a bunch of extra groceries because you have company coming. And so then all of a sudden you failed at your budget and then you need to quote borrow from pants in that category. And it's just a mess. So it keeps money at the forefront of our mind all the time and it makes us feel like we fail. And when we fail at budgeting, we think we're bad with money. And so I hate budgeting. I think everyone should stop budgeting. And so the other side of this equation, kind of figuring out one single line in the sand between money that you can and cannot spend. That's it. That's the only budget. That's it. So once you figured out how much you cost for like your bills and the savings that you want to do to appease that fear-based side that's like, I'm going to be screwed in retirement, everything else that's left over is your money. It's yours to spend and you should spend it. You shouldn't feel guilty spending it because you've already done the work by putting aside the money for like to cover your butt, basically. And then I go one step further and saying like, okay, so we don't care about, I don't care if it's on takeout. I don't care if it's on lattes like or avocado toast. Like, I don't care what you spend your money on. You have permission to blow it to zero every month or every quarter, however it is that you budget or however you forecast. On whatever it is that you want, because life is going to demand things of you differently every single payday. The only thing that I insist on is that you look at your spending and you ensure that you're getting the biggest, something that I call emotional return on investment for your money. So what that means is when you spend, so we only have so much money, right, to spend. So let's make it count and let's make sure that we're spending on stuff that makes us happy and not resentful or guilty or afraid. And so that way, at least when you're spending money, you're spending it for you and not because of what somebody else thinks that you should be spending it on. And you're making sure that you're kind of getting the value for your dollar emotionally. And that way you don't feel guilty or sad or upset about the fact that you kind of are still putting money away for savings, putting money away for bills. And then what's left over is giving you the highest emotional return on investment. And that is how you can spend money and not feel like garbage.
Which probably means having a really keen understanding as to why you need to spend that money in the first place.
Totally. So I go through this whole thing where you actually kind of rate it like on a scale of 1 to 5. And you like look for feelings that are attached to it. So I'll give you a great example. I had one client who spends money on takeout lunch at work every day. And I said, okay, well, how do you feel about that? Like when you see that on your credit card bill or whatever, like how does that make you feel? And she was like, fine, I am single. Like cooking for one person is really tough. And this is when I socialize with my coworkers. And I love trying new places in the city. Like, I don't care. Like, I feel super good about that. I'm like, great. Then I have another client who spends the exact same amount of money every single day on takeout lunches. And I'm like, how does that make you feel? And he's like, the worst. I hate it. It drives me crazy. Every time I see it, I feel like resentful. I feel guilty. It makes me afraid. I feel stupid. So we're talking about the same transaction, same dollar amount, but how it made her feel is completely different than how it made somebody else feel. So, okay, so for this other guy, Brad, it makes sense that he cuts takeout from his budget because it's not fueling him up. It's actually making him feel worse. Whereas for my other client, her name is Lulu, why would I cut takeout? Oh my God, this thing is like making her happy. So like, don't cut that back. That is something that you should keep because you're getting so many positive feels from it. So really kind of paying attention to and the mindfulness around like how we actually feel when we spend money and which are the transactions that are making us feel broke and resentful and afraid and which ones are making us feel proud and excited and joyful. Like those are the ones, regardless of what type they are, that you keep. You kind of dispose of the garbage.
Why do you think we have such complicated emotions with respect to money? It's like the worst on again, off again, high school romance I have ever dissected. Like it's just icky.
Yeah. I think it's because, first of all, money is what allows us to do the things that we want, right? So if you dream about buying a house one day, you need money to do that. If you want to travel, you need money to do that. If you are really into fashion, you need money to do that too. So it is impossible for it to not be somewhat complex because it's completely tied to all of our dreams. And on the flip side, it's also tied to all of our fears because having not enough money can actually be a problem, right? So what is enough? That's the million-dollar question, right? But if you actually don't have enough money, then that can mean bad things for your health and your well-being, right? So it's by its very nature, it's our survival. And we feel like the more that we have, the easier things will become, even though that's not necessarily the case. They've done studies for years that money doesn't buy you happiness, but there, to a certain degree it does, but not after, I think it was, they said $70,000 or something like this.
That's it? You just need $20,000 to buy happiness?
No, 70. I think that they found, don't quote me on this, but I feel like there was a study where they said that if you can earn $70,000 a year in today in North America, you're happy. And everyone who earns money over top of that actually reported to have, they were more unhappy with their financial situation. And I think it's because like mo money, mo problems, right? So I think that
totally.
To answer your question in a roundabout way, I think it has to do with expectations. And I think that the more expectations we have on ourselves, the more fraught with confusion and complexity our money situation will be, because if our finances don't match our expectations, then we feel disappointed.
So what's different about the clients that you have that are not caught up in the need to keep up with the Joneses? Like what is different about their psychology or their upbringing? Like what makes them different?
I don't think that there's a single person in the world that's not trying to keep up with somebody. So I don't think that there's a single client, myself included, nobody is equipped mentally and emotionally to not ever do that. Comparing ourselves to another human being is completely normal. When keeping up with the Joneses gets a bad rep, because a lot of times we look at it like this consumer driven, who's got a nicer car kind of keeping up. And that's not what I'm talking about. When I'm talking about keeping up, I mean like keeping up with your people. If all of your friends are going to out for a birthday party and you can't afford to go, that doesn't mean you're trying to keep up with the Joneses by having a fancier car, but you're still trying to keep up, right? Like you're literally trying to spend money so that you can maintain your social status among the people you care about. And so that's completely human and super normal. And so I don't think anyone is not trying to keep up with someone. It's just, you know, what level are they trying to? So those who have a healthy grip on the comparison game, and I would say that I do have a healthy grip on the comparison game, and I'll tell you exactly why. And this is also something I tackle in the book. I have a reality check every single day with people that are in my peer group that I compare myself to and their finances. So what I mean by that is, okay, so let's say I was on Instagram or something and I saw a peer, somebody I went to school with or somebody who's in my similar age and profession and that kind of thing, and they've just bought a house and I feel like oh, I must be really hurting here because I can't buy a house and that makes me feel like garbage. So the neat thing about my life is that I probably know the financial background around how they did that. So maybe they got a huge, massive payout from family, or they inherited money, or they are so leveraged that they are stressed out and freaking out. So I actually know realistically what's happening to a lot of people behind the scenes. And so that has kind of opted me out of that. Like, I still feel the pangs of inadequacy, but I'm able to snap out of it right away and not get caught up in it and feeling low for a very long period of time, or try to spend my way out of it because I do a quick reality check. I call it the Beyonce factor. I just feel like I'm talking here. I hope that's okay.
It's all good.
I'm just excited. So the Beyonce factor is something that is the antidote to feeling like you can't keep up, or when you're comparing yourself to somebody else, even if you catch yourself by accident doing it. Because to compare is human. And so what it is basically like, I ask a client when they say things to me, like, I don't know how they're doing it. They seem to be like figuring it out. And like, I don't know how they're doing it. The comparison thing right there. That, if you've ever said that, not you, but if anyone has ever said that, you're looking at someone and you're thinking, why are they managing and I'm not? Boom, that's comparison. And so what I usually say is something along the lines of, would you feel, you know, financially inadequate if you didn't have a yacht because Beyonce bought one? And the average answer is like, obviously not. Like, Beyonce buys a yacht, I'm not going to feel crappy about my financial situation and be like, man, I should really get a yacht, you know? So when I say, like, why do you not feel like garbage when if she was to buy a yacht? The answer is like, well, she's in a completely different financial sphere than me. Like, we're not even comparable. She's completely different. And so my answer to that is, well, pretty much so is everyone in your entire life, unless you know the ins and outs of their entire financial situation. So if you know if you're looking at a friend who just bought a house, or someone who's talking at a party about how much they invest, and it sounds like, you know, they just bought a medical marijuana stock and they made 25%, and like, all, you know, all of these things that get buzzed around and talked about that make us feel like maybe we're financially not keeping up, or that we made some bad choices, or something that's making us feel financially inadequate or frustrated about our finances, chances are you don't know the whole story with what's going on financially behind the scenes. Maybe they're leveraged. Maybe they got that inheritance. Maybe the person who just made 25% on a stock actually also has $50,000 worth of losses that they're not telling you about. But you likely don't know the whole story. So you might as well just assume that they're in a different financial sphere than you and stop comparing yourself. And so that's what I call the object factor. Just like, are they Beyonce? Do you know everything about them? No, then they may as well be her, because you don't know how wealthy or poor they are behind the scenes. And so you can't compare yourself to them unless you know everything about them from a financial perspective.
It's such a good point. And I think both of us are in a situation where we are privileged to have access to the behind the scenes elements of people's lives. And yes, that place of privilege has done the same thing for me, where I can quickly pull myself into a reality check where I'm like, whoa, like, no one's story is ever what you see on Instagram. It's like the best possible snippets.
Absolutely.
And we fill in the details based on our own experiences. And it's amazing to me, and you would see the exact same thing, how many people are just so emotionally distraught about where they are relative to someone else, or where their lack of acumen might reside as it pertains to money.
Yep.
One thing I know you're really passionate about and have written about a lot is your interest in really making sure that people are financially literate, that they have the tools. Because I can't help someone with their lifestyle or diet by writing it out on a sheet of paper. I need to give them resources so that they truly understand and can do this themselves. The goal is that they are not dependent on me. And I think that financial literacy works the same way. What are some of the key things that you're like, I just wish people knew this, or these are the fundamental basics or concepts that I just want people to chew on and realize, so they can start to work towards a journey of acknowledging and managing and then taking a leadership role with respect to their finances?
Yeah, what a great question. So I think that, number one, first and foremost, is that I wish people knew that they shouldn't give up. And it sounds a bit trite, but the amount of times that I have seen people who are, you know, trying to get by. Everyone's just doing their thing. And then it gets harder and harder and they just kind of give up. And then it gets astronomically worse, right? And so anything is possible. And even a little bit goes a long way. And I think that's the first thing that I would say is like, even small changes in your life, in your financial life, can have like a snowball effect. And so being motivated is critical. And the second thing I would say, and this is more of like a one of those truisms that we hear in our financial lives all the time that really gets people, is that whole that truism of like, don't stash money, make it work for you. I wish more people talked about money being stashed on the side, like in an emergency account, is working for you, even if it's not invested in earning 5%. Because in today's economy, with like the rise of precarious work and self-employment, contract to contract gigs, and you know, if you own a home, maybe your furnace will break. I don't know. But anyways, I feel like emergency accounts have never been more important. And so if there's one thing that you do besides pay down your debt first, is to build that up. That if you have an emergency account, that is the first fundamental step in feeling like you have your financial shit together, because it's like a warm blanket of calm. When you open up your banking and you see a little padding of money, it pulls you right out of scarcity mode. And you're like, I'm okay. I'm braced for something to happen. And so you don't have to worry as much. Whereas that paycheck to paycheck life is stressful and it's going to be taking a toll on your psyche for sure. And so I think that, and why I say that is that a lot of times during RRSP season, which is the first 2 months of the year, basically, I see a lot of people that maybe they have like $1,000 or something like that, or a couple $1,000s saved up on the sides, which is wonderful. But then they fall into this hype of RRSP season where it's like, don't let your money sit on the sidelines, make it work for you. And then they're like, ah, and they do a knee jerk reaction and they annihilate their emergency account and throw it into an RRSP. Well, then you've completely decimated your emergency savings. So if something goes wrong, if your dog gets sick 2 months from now, you don't have them. You're going to have to use debt to bail yourself out. And there's nothing worse than bailing yourself out of a financial pickle with debt, because it compounds the problem that you feel unprepared and bad with money. So like, if you have it, that's the number one thing for being financially literate, is like, start saving an emergency account before any other goal, except for paying down credit card debt, obviously.
Okay, so these are bringing up really good questions that I know people have, because, you know, a lot of our audience, they're entrepreneurs and they're like, okay, listen, like, I've leveraged myself to start a business and I've got a little bit of debt over here, but interest rates are decent right now. So should I be investing? And it gets really murky and really, really complicated. Yes. Do you have an order? Like, if someone's walking out of school with $100,000 debt, it's going to take them some time to be able to pay that down. Should they be saving at the same time? Are there some ratios or benchmarks or things that they should be aware of?
Yeah, so you'll notice that I said credit card debt. So I feel like student debt gets a little hall pass sometimes. Because you can use the interest that you pay on credit card debt for a tax credit in Canada, which is great if it's a national student loan or a government student loan. And so also if it's going to be with you for like 20 years, then you know you should probably save something else in the meantime. That's okay. It really depends on your own goals, and also how much of is your monthly payment every month. That's also something that can be crippling for some people. So maybe annihilating that student loan does make sense. But either way, what I'm saying is, if you have credit card debt, no matter what, that gets all your attention. Like, yes. I have mortar, yes. Full blown, full bore. It's expensive. It hurts your credit rating. It makes you feel like shit. Like, there's nothing good coming from a credit card at all. From an emotional place, from a financial place, right? So like, neither are happy here. So I would blow that through first. Then I would say your next step is to build that emergency account. Even if you've got some student debt hanging out on the side, if the minimum payment is manageable, and it's just going to be part of your life for the next like 10 years, like, that's okay. I'm okay with that. Like, that's cool. I'm not saying that everyone should just ignore their student debt. I'm just saying, like, if you've got competing goals, and it's a student loan with a manageable minimum payment, and it's going to be with you for some time, then we can start building another life. That's okay. As long as you have no credit card debt or like basically unsecured consumer debt. And then so I'd build that emergency account. And if you're self-employed, I would say you're going to want a big fat emergency account, because like if something happens to you, if you can't work for a few months, that can be, or maybe you just have no clients for a little bit of time, right? Like, that's something that's possible. So I would think you want like 5 to 6 months worth of basic bills and basic food. You don't need to have 6 months worth of extravagant living. You just need, like, can I keep my lights on and can I put food in my belly for 6 months? That's the big piece there. If you're self-employed, if you're an employee, you don't need it as much because you might qualify for EI, right? So we have our emergency account. And then after that, that's when you start getting into the fun stuff, right? So that's when it's like nest egg time and you like, okay, am I saving for a house? Am I saving for long-term retirement? I'm just going to rent for it forever. Like that's when everybody's life gets to come together by design.
And so if we're looking at allocating all of these pieces and we're looking at where we put this cash flow, is there a rule of thumb? Like I grew up in a household where the very first book that was handed to me was The Richest Man in Babylon and you set aside 10%. Is there like a general rule of thumb with respect to paying yourself first that you're teaching to your clients?
Okay, so I also adhere to the 10% rule because it is like a really good ballpark. And I have to be very careful when I say this because yes, the 10% rule is a good check-in, but it's not the be all end all. Some people might need to put more than that away. And some people a lot less. So, cause it really matters on like what expectations do you have for yourself down the road? You know what I mean? Like in retirement, if you want to like travel and buy a yacht, I mean, you're going to need way more than 10%. But if you don't want to do that, then it's okay. Then you can start later. It's still possible to have a retirement that's secure and safe without saving that. So I'm very careful when I say this, but why I say everybody wants the answer to this question, right? Is what is enough? Everybody wants a question for that. And it's really hard for anyone like me to answer because it's so freaking customized. But rule of thumb, generalized, if you can put aside 10% of your after-tax income. So if you make $50,000 a year, it's approximately $3,000 a month after taxes and CPP. So that would mean $300 a month, which would be $3,600 a year. So if you're able to do that, at least you know you're like at a good check-in to say like, okay, I'm kind of on track. But also I can't reiterate this enough. Savings does not necessarily mean savings. It could also mean paying down debt. Anything that is improving your net worth, which means that it's increasing your assets, so that is savings, or decreasing your liabilities, which is paying down debt, improves your net worth. And so savings is anything that does that. So if you're saving $300 a month, but you're putting it all to credit card debt, you're doing the job. Like you're doing your 10% and you're improving your net worth by 10% a year, like that's of your income. That's great. So yes, I think the 10% is important. Make sure you don't get caught up on the specifics of that and also understand that it could be paying down debt as well.
Yeah, I really like that. And I would add, as you are paying down credit card debt, you are improving your health with every payment. Like no one's health is thriving because they accrued credit card debt buying nutraceuticals and vitamins and seeing their naturopath. That is the wrong way to access health.
Yeah, absolutely. The emotional stress that I have seen with clients over the years, even those who make lots of money, like that's what I'm trying to say. It's not just people who are like people who are paycheck to paycheck, are also people who have really solid incomes, right? They overspend. And so, don't be fooled by what you see on paper or what you think you know about other people's lives. And the most stressed out people I know are those who have credit card debt. Or CRA debt, which is another one with self-employed people, right? And so those two, they cause like tummy, gnawing, rats in your stomach anxiety for so many people. And that's why it's also such a huge emotional return on investment to pay that down.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, to put this in a health framework, when you spend money and you get something new and it's all exciting, your body gets filled with dopamine. Dopamine's a neurotransmitter. And there are lots of ways to get that high without spending money.
Yes.
Having purpose, cheering for a sports team, like launching something new, and that doesn't mean a new business. It just might be like a cool initiative at your kid's school. That will all release dopamine as well. So I find for some of my clients, I'm like, you need to check in. Is this really about you needing that? Or did you just need the physiological fix and hit of dopamine? And if so, let's find this in an entirely new way.
I absolutely agree with that. There is such a thing called like shopping high. And I also feel like can I swear on this podcast with the F word or no? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. So I call it the fuck it moment. And so that is something where someone is tired and exhausted. Fuck it. I'll just take a cab or a swipe or like, well, I already have $3,000 on my line of credit. What's another 200? Fuck it. Like, do you know what I mean? Like that mentality, that defeated mentality, giving up before you even try. Everybody has those moments. Like I have them. Everybody has them. But the more frequently you have them is when you start to notice that you're sliding into a situation where you're overspending, you're not saving enough, and maybe you're even taking on credit card debt. And I think that it's matched perfectly with that dopamine. Like you need a bigger hit every time, right? Because if you're having one of those moments, spending money makes you feel good in the moment. It's convenient or it feels good. It appeases some sort of nagging inadequacy that you feel. And it feels good in that moment. But then the next time but it was unhappy spending. It wasn't real, right? And so you're just going to feel resentful and guilty about it. And then you're going to do the same thing again later on that down the road because it's just a Band-Aid that's not really solving the underlying problem.
Yeah, totally. It's financial cocaine.
100%. That's a great way to put it.
Let's just get right in there and call it for what it is.
Dropping an F-bomb, talking about drugs.
There we go. Who knew? Who knew we'd go there? Okay, so you're a parent now. How are you going to take these lessons and principles and things that are just so inherent with respect to how you manage your own life and teach that to your kids?
Yeah, I think I'm going to talk about money really openly and honestly from the day that they can understand. So I grew up in a family business. And so a family business, everybody works there when you're growing up. Like that's what happens. And so I was really involved knowing like when times were good and also when times were not. And my parents didn't hide that from us. So I was very on the pulse of like the fact like, oh, well, this you know, holiday season might be a little bit lean because like we didn't hit our sales and this, that, and the other. So I was really aware that money comes and goes and that it's fluid. And I think that really helped me because I was part of the conversation and the solution. Like my parents would chat about like, okay, well, what are we going to do about this? Well, we're going to do this, this, that, and the other. And so I never felt like money was scary. I always felt like there was possibilities because, oh, okay, well, it's a problem. Well, what's the solution? And now there's a plan and then we'll fix it. So I think that we do our kids a disservice when we try to just pretend like everything's fine and have closed door conversations that are stressful, but keep the kids happy and make sure that they feel not scared. Because kids are, I believe anyways, I was capable of hearing hard news or, you know, scary stuff. Maybe not when they're three, like, but and you'd be surprised maybe at the level of maturity. So I think that making money part of honest conversations with our friends, our family, and our children is like the number one key way that we can all defeat this pressure cooker, consumer-driven environment that a lot of us are finding ourselves in. Because if we're just honest about money, like, hey, I can't afford that, no, then it allows you to say no without hurting someone's feelings instead of just like bailing last minute because of money, but you didn't say that, or like going overspending and then resenting that person or that event. And honest about it, we just make it part of the daily conversation. I think that everyone will grow up understanding that money is weird and sometimes here and sometimes not. And if we fail at money, it's okay. You have to just get back up and try again. And it doesn't mean that you're bad forever.
Yeah, that lack of transparency is a huge one. And then that just like transmitting of beliefs from parents to their kids. I remember I was in a wedding once and I was talking to the bride and she was lamenting about how much money they'd spent and how much debt they had incurred to get married. And I was like, oh gosh. And she's like, yeah, but my mom told me you're a real adult once you have $100,000 debt on your line of credit. So I guess we're there. And I was so struck in that moment that her mother's limiting beliefs around money were just like downloaded in such a disempowering way to her. And like, what a horrific way to kickstart your life.
Yeah. And I totally think that regardless of the message, what we tell our kids stays imprinted for a long, long time. So it's a huge responsibility to create an open, transparent, and also like positive spin on money and also a non-judgmental and shamey. So on the flip side of that example, I often hear parents that are like super shamey to their kids about how they think that they should be spending their money, right? So like the best example is rent versus own. If somebody rents, you're throwing your money away renting. Like I told you how many times clients came in defeated because that's all they kind of got hammered with from their parents. Even though for them in the city, renting is actually 10,000 times more affordable and smarter and has freed up their income so that they can actually save more money and not pile them with an $800,000 mortgage. Like it just, in this city specifically, it can make a lot of sense for people to rent. But that transfer of knowledge is so ingrained in people, whatever they grew up with, that it's really hard to defeat. So yeah, we have a big responsibility with the next generation.
100%. Where are we supposed to learn this stuff? Where are we supposed to learn about money? Where are we supposed to turn to?
Well, okay. So they're actually spearheading pilot programs in Ontario anyways for teaching kids about money, like the civics class, which I think would be phenomenal. I think that money is interesting though. So just like health, you can read everything that there is, but until you actually practice it and learn firsthand what works for you, it's really hard to like put that stuff into practice and live it, right? So I think that learning the basics and just understanding the basics is something that we need to teach the next generation about. And then we need to give people the opportunity to learn through like trial and error and being more transparent about it so that if they do fail, they have resources to help that aren't shamey and judgy and weird. So because a lot of times people keep a lot of their financial stuff in the closet because they're afraid someone's going to be like, oh my God, you spent that money on what? You know what I mean? So like, why would you say if you're afraid that someone's going to judge you?
Yeah. The shame piece around money is just so, so critical. Like it's one thing to teach the fundamentals. It's another thing to really teach how you engage on an emotional level with respect 100%. To money. Yeah.
Which in my mind, money is like 80% emotional and 20% spreadsheets.
It's so true. So what's the first step to getting our mindset wrapped around money? I've had people talk about money on this podcast before and the whole conversation has been energetics. Like if you're not in the right alignment with respect to money on an energetic level, it will never come to you. I'm not sure if that's where you start or where your core beliefs reside around these types of things, but like what is step one for people in terms of changing their relationship with money, not avoiding ever opening your bank account because you don't want to see the number?
Yeah, I think that the first thing that someone should do if they feel scared about money and they feel afraid is this is a funny tip. It's not on a spiritual level. Open up a savings account for free and put $25 a month in there if you can afford that. Because what that will do, like have it automated. And the reason I say that is because it's a very small and most likely manageable action item. One thing that seems manageable, right? And usually if you're a person that's not opening envelopes and not opening bank statements, it's because you're overwhelmed. And so one thing that you can do just to start that ball, and you know what? You'll have $100 in 4 months. And that might be the first time that you've had $100 saved in a long, long time. And I think that I say that because even if you have debt and even if there's all these other competing goals, the reason I'm saying that is that you need to find a way to prove to yourself that there's hope. So that's the problem. People give up when they don't feel motivated because they don't feel like there's a lot of hope. I've tried this a million times and I failed. So what's the point? And so you need to mindset, whatever you want to call it, you need to be in a place where you feel like there's a point to try. And so the only way to really truly prove that to yourself is to see results, but they don't have to be massive. I think that's the important part. They don't have to be massive results. You don't have to be debt free in 3 months. Like that's like trying to lose weight. If you're buy into that whole model where it's like lose weight in 30 days, like, is that a thing we want to be trying for? Like, if it's not healthy for that person. So it's like, okay, well, it doesn't need to be flashy and huge, a little bit. And you'll notice that once you start seeing small nudges of the dial on your finances, you get more excited and you believe more and you're more hopeful and more hopeful. And eventually you're going to find your way to where you need to go. But it's that first step that is often the hardest. So I believe that the action first and then the mindset follows instead of the other way around. And that's because someone who's in a negative mind space about money has probably failed a bunch of times. And so they don't believe that anything will work. So you need to show them that it'll work and then they'll believe it again.
So true. I was reading a book this morning and it was talking about the research related to the sentiment of success. And if you change your own paradigm where you suddenly view yourself as beautiful or view your business as successful, you change the metrics around that, then every yeah. single time they see an acceleration of the outcome that people are after. Because you're right, having $100 after 4 months is way better than $1,200 worth of debt. Because you said, fuck it.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that if you just start to see small changes, you'll start to believe that the bigger picture is possible. And keeping that hope, right? Like, that's what it all comes down to. Like, don't give up. It is totally okay if you feel fucked right now. You don't have to be like that forever. And there is something you can do tomorrow. And the one thing I say is, like, whatever happened before right now, like this very moment, who cares? It's done. It's done. You cannot change it. So, like, so worrying about it, obsessing about it, regretting it, focusing on it is so pointless. All we can do is choose differently tomorrow or 5 minutes from now. You control that. So what a gift that is. And so everything, all of your financial lemons of the past, garbage, who cares? Let it go. Like, just let it go, because there's no point in obsessing about something we can't control anymore. It's like being obsessed with the weather. You can't control it.
Shannon, such great advice. What do you want your legacy to be?
Oh my gosh. was not expecting this question. That's a doozy. Okay, so what would I like my legacy to be? I think that I would like people to remember me or New School Finance or whatever it is you want to call it, my work here in the financial world, as somebody who spearheaded how to fall back in love with your finances, like how to actually like your financial life so that a whole generation of people feel not worried anymore. Because I think that we're at a critical point in history and in our social lives and everything, where everything just feels like a big pressure cooker of scary. And so I'm remembered as somebody who helped to ease that a little bit. I think I've done my job.
I love it. I got another doozy for you.
Oh, yeah.
How would you define health?
I think health is the marriage between our how we feel inside and how we view outside. And both of those being aligned and like functioning optimally. So inside we feel good, it's functioning optimally and we feel positive about it. And how we view the world outside is also as a functional, optimal place that we're excited about. So I feel like it's two parts, and I feel like both of them have to be feeling like, that's not a really eloquent way of saying it, but basically, like, you got to be feeling good on the inside and you have to be projecting good on the outside, and that's health.
Yeah, it's so great. I love asking non-healthcare providers their definition of health, because it's always a new perspective and equally valuable. That was awesome. Each month, I'm featuring a new Anthropology quiz to help you unlock and uncover some of the physical performance blocks that may be holding you back from your true potential. When you know better, you can do better. To learn more or to take the quiz, head on over to meganwalker.com/Anthropology quiz. Okay, so I've got a few rapid fire questions for you. This is the second part of the interview. I call these key performance indicators. So just like we have them in our business, I think we have them in our lives and lifestyle. And it's a chance for people to get to know you behind the scenes a little bit more as well. Are you ready?
Yeah, I'm ready. I'm excited, actually.
Okay, number one, do you have a consistent morning routine? And if so, can you share?
Yes. I get up at either 5:30 or 6, depending on when my 6-month-old baby gets up. And when I'm done, like, you know, feeding him or whatever, I usually do the whole like shower. I eat breakfast every single morning, no matter what. And I cycle to work when I'm working. I cycle to work as much as I can until it's relatively dangerous. And I think that, even before I had a kid who's kind of messed with my morning routine, but before I had a kid, I was still up at 6, like shower, eat breakfast, bike to work every single time. And I found that, like, when I missed my cycle, to work, or if I missed breakfast or I didn't have a coffee, sorry, that's part of it too. I felt like my game was off all day. And so getting that little bit of, morning exercise is so, so, so important to me. And I'm not like a huge gym person. And so for me, doing the like biking to work gives me that endorphin rush that I want in like a super fun way. That's also efficient because it gets me where I need to go.
Fiction or nonfiction? What are you reading right now?
I am reading fiction. I mean, besides my book, a fiction hound. Yeah, I'm a fiction hound. And actually right now, it's so funny, I'm reading my mom's book right now. My mom is a fiction writer. And so I'm reading her book right now, which is called Island Girl, and it's great.
That's amazing. I love, like, you're an author, she's an author. Look at
this. She's a proper author. I'm a financial person who wrote a financial book. My mom is like a proper author.
No, I'm gonna throw you in the proper, you're a proper author to me. Okay.
Well, thank you.
What is the one thing you are most consistent with respect to your health?
Most consistent with my health. I make sure that at least 3 times a week, I get some sort of physical activity, and I always ensure that whether it's yoga or cycling or whatever. And I always ensure I have a very sedentary job. So I sit in meetings all the time for like giving financial advice, or I'm like working and stuff. So I set a timer on my phone. And every hour I get up and I walk up and down the hall for at least 5 minutes, which I know doesn't sound like a lot, but you'd be surprised how annoying that buzzer is when you get kind of caught in the grind. I've never told a client to just wait for 5 minutes while I've done it. I usually will wait till they're gone. But I definitely am sure to get up and walk up and down the halls. Like, my office will know that.
That little bit of movement is like the $25 a month. So don't sell it short. It's important.
That's it, right? So it's not fancy, but it's at least going, and especially after giving birth, it's like my hips, oh my god, so I definitely need to move.
For sure. Now, believe me, I get it. What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
I play music, and I used to be in a Bruce Springsteen cover band, and then I was in a family band that played 1970s rock covers at the Legion in Northern Ontario.
That is badass. Bruce Springsteen cover band / Legion playing musician. That's amazing.
I sang backup and play the keyboard.
So great. What do you do for fun or play?
Pardon me?
What do you do for fun or play?
Ooh, okay. So play music. For play, I would say my favorite place in the world is my cottage. And so it's like family cottage. I've been very blessed to have it in my family. And so I guess that's like where I go when I'm my absolute happiest. So like cottage time is playtime for me. But I also play in my daily life just by being silly with my family. My husband's hilarious, and we just like goof around. I think this is my answer. On a daily basis, I turn my phone off at around 9:30, or at least I try to most nights. And that is like playtime, right? So that is like laughing and hanging out and chatting and not scrolling. And that is something I implemented not too long ago, because I realized that at night I was like still furiously working, and I would go to bed, like I would shut my phone down and then go to bed, and everything that I just wrote is still in my mind. And I wasn't actually laughing that much before bed and hanging out, because I was like doing stuff. And so we just implemented that. It's had a huge effect. It's been wonderful.
I love it. I feel like I should be implementing that.
Honestly, it was really hard. And the first week felt like I had never realized how addicted to my phone that I really was until I tried not to be around it. And so I actually had to put it in another room. So it made me very aware of how much we were checking our phones. And we both laughed about how addicted we were. And to nothing, like scrolling through Reddit or like going through social media, like nothing. There's nothing that we're doing that's really super important. And that's why we started that. I mean, obviously there are nights when I'm like working late furiously and it is what it is. But there's definitely an effort to not do that. And so it only happens now if it's like actually a work emergency or actually something that I need to be doing.
So great. Last question for you. Entrepreneurism. Are we born this way, or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
Ooh, that's a great question. I think anyone can be an entrepreneur, but I do think that people who get off on it, because there's people who are really good at being self-employed, but they could go either way, right? They could be an employee, they could be self-employed, whatever. It's all good as long as they can like pay their bills and eat, that's fine. Then there are those who are driven by a higher calling to be self-employed, even if they're not really making money or it's the hardest thing ever. And that, I think you're born with it. I think that those people who have that drive and that persistence and the like never giving up. And if you can riff with a friend and all you want to do is make up businesses, I think that's that different mindset, right? So it's like, I know an entrepreneur from far away, even if they are an employee, because they see an opportunity at every corner. Like you're going for coffee and they're like, so there's this many people, there's this many, probably $2 a person, this probably is probably making this. I wonder if they could do this. Oh, like that is somebody who is a natural born entrepreneur. That's not to say that those who are entrepreneurs that aren't like that are not able to. It just means that maybe they could go either way, right? Like they're indifferent. They're not driven by something that even if it's failing, someone who's a born entrepreneur will probably still fall down the rabbit hole with it because they're obsessed.
I feel like this is a case of it takes one to know one.
Yes. Yeah. 100%. I know one when I feel one and when you see one, because you're like, you would literally do anything to achieve that.
For and that's sure.
Entrepreneurship. Yeah.
For sure. The volley of ideas that occurs. Shannon, you are up to so many incredible things. Today is the launch day of your book, which was just perfect timing. Where can people find out more about what you are up to and the New School of Finance?
Yeah. So the website is newschooloffinance.com, and you can find our advice only, like fee only service there. You can find our online DIY courses. And you can also find a link to Worry Free Money, which is the book that is out today. And I'm freaking out / super excited.
Amazing.
So I hope you check out all three.
Yeah. Well, and we'll have everything available in the show notes. Shannon, it was such a pleasure to have you. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. This was great.
If you enjoyed our conversation and would like to hear more, head on over to Stitcher or iTunes and subscribe to the Entrepology Podcast. We would also really appreciate a quick review. When people have their health, they can change the world. Let us keep you healthy and you go change the world.